you want a vision of the future, Winston, imagine a boot stamping on a human face forever.
You want answers?
I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth! You can't handle the truth!
Someone is trying to teach me a lesson in futility. Why am I the only one who isn't killed?
They will run you dizzy. They will pile falsehood on top of falsehood until you can't tell a lie from the truth and you won't even want to. That's how the powerful keep their power. Don't you read the papers?
I just want to say one word to you. Just one word.
Yes, sir.
Are you listening?
Yes, sir, you.
Plastics.
I'm going to get your money for you. But if you don't get the President of the United States on that phone, you know what's going to happen to you?
What?
You're going to have to answer to the Coca-Cola company.
The world is a college of corporations, inexorably determined by the immutable bylaws of business. The world is a business, Mr. Beale. It has been since man crawled out of the slime.
Welcome to another episode of Our Interesting Times. It's my pleasure to have Borzoi Basovic on the show. Borzoi Basovic, he is the co-host of The Pause Button and also The Third Rail, two different shows that are carried on the Right Stuff Network, the rightstuff.biz. Is that correct?
Yes, actually it's Boscovich, the with the Balkan names. I know that that C can always throw people.
Oh,
people,
okay.
People off. Yeah, like if you ever look at like a Serbian or Croatian name, they got the little C with the diacritical mark above.
That's right,
it's actually an itch sound. So yeah.
Okay. Just, thank you.
Yeah, Borzoi Basovic.
Borzoi Basovic.
But yeah, absolutely. You can find all that stuff on the, like, all my stuff is on the rightstuff.biz. I also have a YouTube channel where we do streaming. You can just find it by searching Borzoi Basovic on there as well.
How often do your shows get purged?
Well, considering that my good friends at the Myth of the 20th Century have just lost their channel, as of this week when we're recording this, I expect that we'll probably lose ours within a couple weeks here. They lost their channel around about 10,000 subscribers. I'm at about 9,000, so I think it's a TikTok on that YouTube channel.
Yeah, I have a little over 14,000 right now, and I've gotten one video removed and a strike, which prevented me from uploading for a week. And now what I'm doing is I'm using YouTube as just a promotion button. So if you want to listen to this, go here and see how long that lasts.
Yeah, it's I'm actually surprised that the Myth guys were taken down before we were, because there's a couple people that really do not like us quite a bit. And part of that's me. Part of that is the fact that I co-host a show with Eric Stryker called The People's Square. So it's a shared group guilt there. But I'm just surprised that ours hasn't gone down yet. But it's coming. I mean, like, I'm not special in that regard. It's coming.
Yeah,
it's coming. It's coming for all of us.
Yeah. The censorship and these things and these platforms are not neutral, that's fairly obvious at this point. And of course the Right Stuff Network, that is, well, if you listen to the material, it's not quite fit for polite society, correct?
Well, yeah, we it depends on kind of what you're like, what shows you listen to on there. I mean, like the main, the flagship show TDS is, I wouldn't call that family friendly. There, we do have a show like that. I used to be a panelist on. I'm still friends with them, but I don't do the show with them anymore. The Godcast, which is a more obviously a more Christian focused episode. I do believe that they keep it family friendly as much as possible. Though I do recall even when during my tenure there, we did have our own slippage from time to time. But for the listeners of your show, I think they might feel at home with the Godcast. I know they had E. Michael Jones on.
Yes, recently. I listened to that.
It's an episode. Recent one. Yeah.
And, of course, that is Subscriber, correct? That we network?
I'm sorry?
The rightstuff.biz, that's subscribed. You can subscribe to it, right?
Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, every show's going to have its own RSS feed. TRS is more like a platform, like a visibility more than anything else. Every show kind of manages its own affairs unless they're part of the TRS. Like, and not all – like, there's a paywall up there, but not all shows are paywalled. So some of the kind of like the main shows of the network would be TDS, Strike and Mike, and Fetch the Nation, and also now the Europa Report, which is actually that one would be very family-friendly if you want just like a pure like news kind of breakdown on the European perspective. You would want to listen to the Europa Report, and Fetch the Nation is actually pretty family-friendly as well in terms of like that's like just generally very crunchy news analysis more than anything else. But where was I even going with this? I don't remember. The odd thing is like my show, because I've been on a number of different shows. My show, the pause button, I've been told by people is actually pretty friendly to people, not family friendly, but friendly to people who are kind of like interested in these ideas for the first time. Mm-hmm. And I'm not surprised to hear that because I have not done a great job of explaining what I'm all about, but my show is a media analysis show, but it's not really like analyzing the cinematography of a film, but more of like how we interpret our reality through media, because media is so ever present in our lives. So, you know, go check out my show, look for a movie that you like or you've seen, and then check it out, see if you like it.
Yeah, it's there's critiques of movies, and of course, a lot of the material it doesn't really fit into the sort of this left right paradigm that we in America think is the, you know, sort of the Overton window, the acceptable limits of public discourse and ideas. Yo. Yeah. So it's hard to really characterize the views that are expressed. I guess you could say sort of nationalist, traditionalist, I don't want to say third way, but there's a lot of, I mean, you really can't pin anyone on.
I would guess that a lot of the guys that are associated with the TRS platform, the rightstuff.biz platform, would probably, if you were to press them on an easy way to explain their views, I think most of them would probably say third positionist. But that's what I love about this milieu we're in. It's like you actually get, like when you get, like break people down, like you will actually discover a true diversity of views. Like just take my show, for instance, The Pause Button. Like that's my show, but I've taken J.O. Del Rey on as kind of a regular co-host for it. Like I'm known for being a little bit more to the left on economic issues. Like I'm not like, I just have more of like an economic populist kind of workers' rights perspective than some of the other people associated with the site. J.O. jokingly calls himself a racist libertarian. And also, like, one other thing that I stand out is, like, I'm much more an environmentalist than most of the guys of the site are. And that's fine. Like, I've actually had really great debates with people associated with the site on a variety of different topics, which I think is what makes the content very robust.
Yes, it is. That's a good way to describe it. And it is. It's just very provocative, thought-provoking. These are ideas that you don't see on Fox News or MSNBC or CNN. Tonight, you know, I want to talk about, you kind of, your show, your podcast, The Pause Button, these movie critiques that you do, how really these movies actually form the culture, which shape the politics. And perhaps we can talk about that and maybe your other show and some of the issues you brought up on these shows. I know you recently did an excellent podcast, a very disturbing and provocative one on the movie Hardcore.
Yes.
And also perhaps we could talk about, this certain culture trends, the demographic trends in the country, and how it's likely to shape future politics. And of course, how do we respond to this challenge? So the pause button, you analyze these movies, and you recently did something on Hardcore with Nick Mason, as you mentioned, was over there, he's the co-host at Myth of the 20th Century.
Yeah.
Want to talk about that?
Yeah, that's not really a recent episode, just for your audience knows that they start like trying to dig through my archives to find it, because I did that episode nearly a year ago.
Oh, okay.
Now, so I go on long hiatuses, so maybe it's not as far back as it'll seem in the archives, but you might need to dig a little bit back just to find that episode. But I consider that a top five episode, and just to quickly make the case for your audience of why I think it's worth checking out my show is because the thing. I think you appeal, like you speak to a much more traditionally minded, religiously minded audience, especially on the Catholic side of things. The thing to understand is like the society that we're living in now is like, even if you have people that are considered themselves like nominally religious, like we live in a very a-religious or irreligious society. And so what people go to instead is like they need something that to fill that aspect of their lives, and people fill it with media. And we see this constantly. I bring up a term quite a bit called hyperreality. And what hyperreality, if you get into like postmodern philosophy like Baudrillard and all that, what hyperreality basically is because of the how ever-present technology and media technology is in our lives, that has an effect on how people perceive reality. So what they see on TV and movies is realer to them than what they see in real life. This is the example I always use, that blood in real life never looks as real to them as the blood on TV does, because everything on media is designed to be much more appealing to your senses. So with that in mind, going into this hardcore episode, why I would probably highly recommend this episode, especially to your audience, is so the movie Hardcore is a 1978-1979 Paul Schrader, who wrote the movie Taxi Driver, Paul Schrader film about a Dutch Calvinist father from Western Michigan, played by George C. Scott, whose daughter disappears after she's on a Bible trip. And his Dutch Calvinist faith is an integral part of this. And there's a famous scene in the movie. This is probably the scene that people most, if they know anything about this movie, this is the scene that everyone knows about, is where this private investigator finally says he's tracked down his daughter. And he takes him to the seedy movie theater, and he shows him this pornographic film that has his daughter in it. And the guy, obviously, he's distraught, in tears, screaming at him to turn it off. And the movie goes from there of him trying to track down his daughter and bring her back and try to figure out what happened to her. Now, the movie itself is actually with premise like that, especially being in the 70s, it's actually quite a tame movie. But what's interesting about that is that you have this theme in this movie at that time of ultimately. And it's kind of brought up when the private investigators bring in the father along to pointing out to him, they've been living this nice little religious life in rural Michigan, but the quote unquote real world is imposing itself on them. Like, you can't hide from modernity forever. So there's this theme in the movie is that you can't they're not going to leave you alone. The culture is not going to leave you alone. If you have a pornographic culture, it's not going to leave you alone. And because it's a pornographic culture, ultimately, who is it going to be most interested in? Your daughters. And that's a huge aspect of this movie. That's ultimately what Nick Mason and I ended up breaking down in this is, we get into other aspects of it with the power of pornography as a weapon that's used to basically completely demoralize and destroy a family and a people and a race. But that's ultimately what the pause button goes into on that. It's those elements that are in that movie now reverberate in our society.
Yeah, that was what the more powerful points that I took from that show is that we live in a society that is pornographic. That's the default position now, and it will not leave you alone no matter where you are. It must keep on feeding.
Well, this is I've been meaning to write an article critical of, I think it's Dreher, the Dreher's position of the Benedict option and all of that. And I understand where people get into that mindset. And I think a lot of that comes from just not understanding how the power structure works, one, and two, who's actually operating in that power structure, and three, what their ultimate aims are. People have this kind of naive idea of power and the people in power that they're just in it to kind of for their own self edification and to be in control and to basically to give favor more to their constituent groups. And of course those elements are always there, but I think people have trouble really conceptualizing that there is a very malevolent streak to the people who control the culture, and they have a very malicious mindset towards the people that make up the bulk of the people that, you know, resided in this country, especially religious folks. And so these unfortunate souls who have this naive mindset about it, like when they saw the culture changing and saw like what was happening, they thought like, well, we're gonna go off here and do our own thing, you know, you just like, you know, and this is like how we got gay marriage, really. It was like, you know, you do your thing, I'll do my thing, we'll tolerate each other, like we're just like, we'll leave each other alone, like it's just like, I don't want this to affect me. I don't want this to affect my children, but, you know, and I don't like what you're doing, but, you know, just stay there and you do it. And I'm not going to say anything. I'm not going to get involved. Just please leave me alone. Like, this has been the mindset for the past 50, 60 years.
Yeah, that's the boomer mindset that keeps on retreating, by the way.
Well, and yeah, I mean, they learned it from somewhere because it's like, it was the exact, obviously like the greatest generation, the silent generation, you know, they had much more reactionary tendencies than the boomers do. But I mean, the boomers learned this idea of retreating, that people should be left alone, you know, should be allowed to do their own thing as long as they're not, you know, imposing on other people. Like, I mean, they learned it from, I mean, obviously they learned it in the schools, but they also learned it from they learned the idea of retreat from their parents and from their grandparents, who didn't do anything to oppose the social changes in this country either. But I mean, there was always a limitation on what they were going to do. I mean, desegregation was not popular in this country. There was a poll that was run during World War II, and maybe I'll get like the citation for you for the notes later on or something, but there was a poll that was run during World War II where they discovered that basically if Americans knew that that fighting in the war would lead to desegregation, they would not have supported war in World War II. Basically, if the changes that were being brought by the war, the point of the poll was that while Americans were patriotic to fight in the war because they're patriotic for their country, if it meant that desegregation would have to occur, they would have been opposed to that war, because desegregation was never popular here, but it was imposed. Children were marched to school by the National Guard. That was a thing that happened. And ultimately, what Americans, especially traditional and conservative-minded Americans, learned, whether they wanted to admit it themselves or not, is that they were not in control, and that these changes were going to be imposed upon them. They thought they could like negotiate a retreat and surrender by like, okay, we'll stay in, we'll keep moving away, we'll keep moving one exit down the road, we'll do our thing, you do your thing. But there, I mean, people put the power plays for keeps. Like, there's not going to be anything that they're going to allow to exist outside of their domain.
Yeah, and the you won't be able to escape it, and your consent will not be required because you must submit to it.
Now, there's an argument that could be made that that these kind of concessions could have been made to buy time, but ultimately nobody used it to buy time. That this is like the issue that we're confronted with constantly, and this is the ultimate problem of people who consider themselves kind of reactionaries and conservatives. I don't hold any ill will towards people that with that mindset. I just don't consider myself that to be one, because the position has always been kind of a negotiated retreat and negotiated surrender. But there comes a point when you run out of land that you can retreat to, and we're getting to that point now. I mean, we're at the point of drag queen story hour, and there are people protesting it, and there are people trying to disrupt it. But I mean, at what point are people going to actually, you know, do something? Like, and now we're seeing a little bit of a snapback with the GLAAD poll. Like, I guess, like, I try not to be too depressing. We say blackballing. I try not to be too depressing about this stuff. I mean, I generally tell people, like, it's going to get rough. It's going to get very, very difficult. But, I mean, there are bright spots along the way, such as GLAAD doing their own internal poll of the country and discovering that support among for homosexuality has dropped among young people, which, you know, considering we keep hearing about how every generation than the last is getting gayer than the last, I don't know if it's news to celebrate about, but these are bright spots, meaning like there is some soul of sanity that exists somewhere in this country.
Yeah, to your point about them, you know, they don't want to be left alone. They want to seek out and find fresh quarry.
Yeah,
virgins, pure. Al Goldstein, I think, was the one. I think it was Al Goldstein, the publisher of Screw Magazine, was asked, what he enjoyed. He liked deflowering Catholic girls.
This is something you see. They've gone after all Christians, but the target of Catholic girls has always been very, very focused. I mean, Schrader's movie Hardcore, it was about Dutch Calvinists because Paul Schrader was from a Dutch Calvinist family. He was from Western Michigan himself. Like, so this is a movie that kind of came from his experience, from what he was seeing going on in the culture and change. Like, there's a very reactionary streak that runs through a lot of Paul Schrader's movies. I mean, he's a guy who coming from like this very quiet religious family in Western Michigan, and then becoming, marinating in the culture of Hollywood and LA. Like, these two, like, he's had this duality to him, and this duality appears in the movies. But if it were not Paul Schrader's personal experiences that were informing that film, that would have been about a Catholic girl who disappeared. Yeah. It would have been about a religious Catholic father, because that's who they're most obsessed with more than anything else. Like, there's a certain pathology. It's not just because, and I don't think it's just because, like, I think at this point Catholicism is the largest Christian denomination in the United States. It's not just because of that. There's many multifaceted reasons for that. But like, you see this, especially like Jewish men in particular, I've noticed, have a particular obsession with Catholic girls. I mean, like, you have the famous Billy Joel song about them. I mean, like, you have the Al Goldstein thing. I mean, like, the way white guys have the Asian fever thing. I guess Jewish men have like this weird kind of neurotic sexual obsession with
Catholics. There's the plaid skirt in the Britney Spears video, and
yeah,
she's sort of bringing up to mind the Catholic schoolgirl outfit.
And I'm not Catholic myself, but I come from a lapsed Catholic family. Without stating my age, I'm a millennial. I've always been open about the fact that I'm a millennial. So I was in school when that Britney Spears video first came out. Like, Britney Spears was one of the first like big pop stars for the millennial generation. Like,
for tweens, which I thought was always strange. Yeah.
I was around that age range when that happened. And obviously, as a child, you're not going to you're not going to understand the implications of all that. But looking back on it now, it is that's a very fortuitous event, basically, in terms of, like, because I remember seeing in real time like the absolute degradation of the Catholic Church within my generation. I had always kind of like, because I was not raised going to church or anything like that, but I had a lot of friends who were Catholic. I saw in real time them falling away from the church. Culture plays such a huge aspect in that. Like I said, it's very fortuitous that music video, that Britney Spears music video, was one of the big things among my generation, my tween generation. And I mean, if people don't think that, like, people have this naive tendency to just like look at a media as like, oh, it's just a music video. Oh, like, why are you getting so upset about this? This is just, you know, this is just a disposable piece of pop culture entertainment. It doesn't mean anything. Was actually the scariest thing is that pop culture entertainment, even the most vacuous kind, is the most dangerous kind of all, because it's so insidious in the effects that it can have on people.
And it's definitely been weaponized. It isn't just lowest common denominator, mass appeal. These things actually, instead of, you know, the music industry responding to popular demand, it's the music industry actually shaping popular demand through the machine of mass communication, mass entertainment. One point that you and Nick made, which is very important, is that often when we think of exploitation, the trafficking of children, minors, that we imagine girls being kidnapped or tricked. In a sense, they are tricked. But like in the movie, is many girls, many children or young people, particularly women or young girls, would choose this because of marinating in the culture, the pop culture.
Yeah. Well, I'll give you a modern example right now. Like, what easier way are you going to get young people to get into pornography than like the formative experience they had when their mother took them to the library to have a drag queen read to them?
Yeah.
This is the insanity of it, really.
And if you protest, the local authorities will bring out the SWAT team to protect the drag queen.
Literally, that will happen. I mean, we have a meme that comes from Sam Hyde. We have a meme, state enforced homosexuality, and that was when Sam Hyde did. So if your audience doesn't know about Sam Hyde, kind of like a post-ironic comedian, and a lot of his claim to fame, his early rise to fame was doing his own IRL trolls of different events and comedy and comedy clubs and the like. Well, the one that really brought his attention to people for the first time was a troll he did of a TEDx seminar where it was, I forget what it was called, 2079 paradigm shift. It was called something like that, where it was basically just an absolute parody of all these backslapping TEDx seminars about how forward thinking and progressive and liberal they are. And one of the things he brings up is that, we're going to have in a very proud way, putting it out there as part of it, is that we're going to have state enforced homosexuality. Well, in less than five, I think it was within less than 5 years of Sam Hyde doing that bit, we live under a homo imperium now. So, I mean, that's how fast the stuff accelerates. This is a thing I bring up constantly in my podcast. The problem that people make when it comes to social changes is they think too much in a modern mindset when they need to be thinking in a postmodern mindset. With the modern mindset, people see social change is coming a little bit slower. Now obviously things get picked up a little bit, but change kind of comes slowly over time. That's what they imagined what was going to go on with gay rights and all this. So we're moving through a slow social change. Here's the force multiplier that people never ever consider. It's until you start thinking about this thing that you realize how much this, you cannot have any serious position on anything until you take this into consideration, is technology. Technology runs our lives. Technology rules our lives. Technology is our lives. And with technology, you can accelerate everything in a way that is not that is just inconceivable to your great grandparents and especially to anybody from 200 years ago. When Ted Kaczynski wrote in Industrial Society and Its Future, the Industrial Revolution and its consequences have been a disaster for the human race, this is the kind of stuff he was talking about, because things have gone so beyond our reach that it is now warping people's perception of reality itself, which is the stuff that the postmodern philosophers were starting to clue into with Debord having he had his own Marxist critiques of what he called the spectacle. But most importantly, the one who informed Kaczynski the most was Jacques Ellul, who wrote The Technological Society. And basically his point was what forms is what's called technique, which is basically the totality of technology and how it is always present in our lives. And that's all these things converge. All of these things absolutely converge, because without technology, you would not have widespread pornography. It would not be possible to have such a thing. Obviously, there's always been there's always been lewd materials, but they've never been able to be mass produced on a large scale, and they've never been able to be as realistic to people. There's a difference between making a raunchy drawing from a couple hundred years ago. I mean, tequila Bibles, as they called them, have always been around. But to now, where we have VR pornography, where they try to put you into that position, into that mindset right there. So you have that. And so at the same time, homosexuality is also aided and abetted by all of this, because a lot of homosexuality is reliant upon technology in order to propagate it and to spread it even further.
Yeah, pornography wasn't an issue until the creation of the of film.
Yeah,
film projector and moving pictures, and that's when it became a phenomenon. Of course, with the advent of, up until the late '90s, it was relegated to videotapes, VHS tapes, and DVDs at that point, perhaps, and movie houses. But then, with the internet, and they started streaming with the Communications Decency Act, where they actually allowed for the streaming of pornography in the name of free expression and free speech and art.
And what did this all of these things tied together? All of this, all these things tied together, because what technology Something that Marshall McLuhan, who was kind of like the godfather to a lot of this stuff, he analyzed the impact of media long before anyone else really did. He kind of understood the implications of a lot of this stuff. One thing I remember him saying during one of his lectures is that privacy was an invention of books, basically. That there was really no need for privacy until literacy really became a thing. I mean, like, obviously there are intimate acts that people would probably rather do in private, but I mean, like, long-term privacy was basically an invention of books, because like you need a place to be, for a quiet place, in order to sit down and read a book and collect your thoughts on that stuff. Like that's an early example of how the medium is what affects our lives more than anything else. Now, what technological media does is it actually de-emphasizes privacy. So like with social media, like there's no, you don't, like, what's our one concern we're constantly having with this is privacy. Like we can't see, it's saturating every aspect of our lives, and because it has this dopamine effect on you where it's, you know, doing that drip into your brain, it basically tricks you into giving up your privacy, because the only way you can get the dopamine is by giving up content, by giving up a part of yourself to other people in order to view that, who will give you the dopamine fix that you need. Like this so it's not for nothing that homosexuality and all this queer stuff goes hand in hand with all of this stuff, because you have the element of where people need to because people need a cause, they need to signal for somebody else's rights. So homosexuals fill that void right there, because there are certain kind of, like, it's not for nothing that with homosexuality you have comorbidity with like a lot of drug issues, a lot of other addiction issues, and a lot of other dysfunctional issues. So that stuff helps to aid and abet that as well, these different fixes and obsessions, because there's a huge novelty function of that, where people who, you know, where homosexuals tend to seek either like some kind of sexual novelty or constantly new partners or the like. There's always the need to expand the market. Like, this is why like homosexuality was never ever going to be a thing where it was like they're gonna, like, we'll keep them on Castro Street, you know, we'll wall them in there and they can do their weird stuff, and as long as I don't have to see it, like, then I'm not going to bother with, you know, with what they're doing. It's like that was never, as soon as they were able to get, you know, a foothold into power, it was always going to expand. You always see this. You always see this in decadent societies and decadent empires. The Western Empire had it with like its with Elagabalus, I think it was called. Like, I'm always terrible with these Roman names, but you basically had like a transsexual emperor who I think had like started as a catamite or the like. I'm kind of butchering my history on this, but you had Justinian under the Eastern Roman Empire had to institute a bunch of reforms because sodomy had become such a massive issue in the culture surrounding that place. And then of course the Ottoman Empire was known for this stuff as well. When you get into these complex technological societies, like, everything begins to aid and abet that. There's usually like that rubber band effect that, you know, busts things back into place and things kind of reset themselves. But that's the danger of technology, is that reset is not as readily available anymore, because technology gives people in control more control than they've ever had in their lives, than any, you know, group of people has ever had in their lives. And that's what we're going, that's why it's very dangerous for religious people to kind of like do this religious retreat position, because it's going to get to the point where not only is there nowhere else for you to retreat to, but they're going to, like, now that they are refining the methods of propaganda and how to keep replicating this stuff, like, now they're like, why not expand the market, like, you know, this psychic market right into your children, because now they have access to them.
Yeah, and that's why personally as I'm raising three daughters, this is a concern of mine. I was also concerned for my sons.
Yeah, terrifying, I know.
But I as they get older, and I can talk more about these things, particularly with the older daughters, I just explained to them that the world is full of demons seeking your destruction, and they'll compliment you, they'll play to your vanity, and all this is, you know, they'll say, you know, you can be independent and strong in these things, all these tricks that they play. And they're all in seek of your destruction. And if you doubt that, just take a look around you.
To be honest, like I tend to go on these long filibusters. I often think I'm probably coming off as like a rambling madman. So for like for people, like if you want to know, if you want to understand what I believe, like what I believe is that the world is run by technological demons that are interested in your children. And if you doubt me, I welcome any evidence to the contrary, because I think right now when I look outside my door, I'm being vindicated every day on this.
Yeah, sometimes I'm going off, you know, at the dinner table or walking through the kitchen. And I'll make a comment about women. I said, well, most women are insane now because most women are postmodern. And
yeah.
It's by definition insane. They don't even know it. But just their presumptions in these things, and their basket cases. They're unhappy. They're, you know, and this is the modern world. You know.
And that's why I was really happy to come on this program, because I think you probably appeal to I don't know if I want to say the term older, but like people with a more, let's say, like I said, more traditional mindset. What they would probably have is what Rick Roderick would call a modern mindset. And I'm here to present what the postmodern mindset is. So Rick Roderick has a very famous lecture. I bring it up all the time. I'm sure like anybody who's listened to me is so sick to death of me bringing this up. But it's a great entry point into all these ideas. He did an eight-part lecture series called The Self Under Siege. And it's the philosophical understanding through the various philosophers of how in the society we're coming into, the personal self is under constant siege. And I think, again, he's being vindicated in this. Well, in his final one, his Fatal Strategies lecture, where he talks about Baudrillard and explains Baudrillard's philosophy, one thing he talks about, this is in relationship with his son, because Rick Roderick was a boomer himself, and so his son would have been probably been like a millennial, like I'm gonna guess like a millennial, either that or like a zennial, maybe late Xer, mm-hmm. depending on when his son was born. But one thing he talks about in this is that he has a modern mindset, modern being like how modernism, like we're basically with what modernism is, like that's like post-industrial revolution, where things like the dust has begun to settle, like we've industrialized, you know, like the ideologies have more or less settled, like religion's beginning to make a retreat out of people's lives, and things are moving more towards a scientific mindset, and that's where people were. Well, his son had the post-modern mindset because his son was raised, because like somebody like Rick Roderick had a childhood, a boomer childhood, where like while they did have the television, there wasn't technology around them constantly. There was still like this kind of like, we'll call it like normalcy. There was still this normalcy.
Yeah, they'd play in the woods.
Yeah, they played in the woods. Perfect example. They played in the woods. And he brings up like how his son would get frustrated at a video game he was playing, and the whole experience was very perplexing to him. And he realized, well, of course my son's being frustrated by that. That video game is his world, is his life. It might as well be real to him. That's hyper real. The video game is more real to him than anything about him. Like that's the postmodern mindset, because it's not something you adopt. It's something that was like basically foisted upon you because you were born into a postmodern society where you are surrounded at every waking moment by technology and by media. Like, I mean, like look, people would, I remember when I was growing up as a millennial, like, how big of a deal it was that people were getting cell phones, and people were like, there was still a lot of debate and a lot of debate. And it's like, I wasn't allowed to have a cell phone until I was at least 18 years old. Like it was very restrictive when that occurred. I go into a restaurant nowadays, I'm going to see like with any family, their 4 or 5 year old child, 3 year old child in front of with a tablet in front of them,
mm-hmm.
you know, to distract mm-hmm. like that media is now like, that is like, it is a nearly a biological part of that, which is why like any kind of like body horror movies like that, especially like Videodrome, are great movies to watch if you want to get like, if you want to feel true existential horror, because like technology is going to be integrated with us one way or the other. And we may not live to see the point where we are literally born with, you know, like cyborg appendages coming up, but there's finding studies that 5G is causing people to grow horns out of their head. So we're getting there. We're definitely getting there. These are terrifying end times we're living in, but we're definitely getting there.
Well, I noticed, and this is how one observation I made that's been made actually by other people is going to my son's Little League games, and I've seen that the marked deterioration in physical skills in kids.
Yeah.
When I was 11 or 12, I wasn't a star baseball player. but I pretty much knew all the rules and how to play, and I, you know, I didn't embarrass myself out in the field. I was just, you know, I could shag fly balls, and most people on the team could. And I'm watching kids that just don't have the same skill level anymore, because their childhood, when I was 9, 10, 11, and the weather was nice outside, I was outside practicing baseball. And apparently more kids now are just playing video games. And although they may play a little bit, it just isn't there. And I actually, some of the coaches are very frustrated, but these coaches are boomers. Yeah. And
let me guess, they probably blame the self-esteem culture for this.
Well, that and that. And, but then again, it's, you know, it's this technology. And I remember 10 years ago, my siblings debating whether or not their kids should have phones. And it was all based on this justification of not convenience, but safety, because they can call if there's an issue. They can call. And I don't know how, you know, we all survived our youth without any phones, and, you know, maybe we'd use a payphone. But then all of a sudden the smartphones came out. Now it's like uninterrupted media, unlimited.
Well, you know. Is this not the most most ingeniously insidious and terrifying aspect of this? Is like, why did you give your child a cell phone? Like, why did you give your child a piece of technology to make them safe? Because you watch another piece of technology that told you the world is not safe.
Yes.
So the people who make the technology that's scaring you are scaring you into buying more technology in order to control you by telling you it'll make you safer.
That technology changes their kids. I've seen this in family, extended family, is the millennial generation that came of age the past 10 years. They're kind of a lost generation.
Yeah.
You know.
I'm sorry, which generation?
They came of age the past 10 years. You know,
teenagers. Oh, yeah. Okay.
Now they're in their early 20s.
So basically like late millennials.
Yeah, late millennials. Yeah, I don't know. What are they now? What do they call them? Generation?
Well, Zoomer. So the generation. I think we're going to start to go on a little tangent here about this. Like, I think we're going to get to the point like that. Zoomers might be the last generation, and they're going to be like, I think they might be the last generation in terms of like where the word generation has any meaning. Mm-hmm. Because a generation, like there's that famous book, I think it's the Strauss and Howe, I can't remember what their names were, like the famous like book about generations, that like, you know, it's generations are supposed to go in cycles, like it follows kind of like that's what I love about like the kind of stuff that I like to read about, is like there's this kind of like Spenglerian and Toynbee cyclical views of history here, which I really dig, follows you know, Tainter's the collapse of civilizations and the like, and can see this like within generations themselves. Hard men create good times create hard men create good times create weak men create hard times, and then you know, the cycle continues. I might have botched that a little bit, but my point about generations is, so they say that the generation after Zoomers, like right now, like it hasn't been named yet, but like there's a couple of names floating out there, and one they're going with is Generation Alpha, because like you have Gen X, Gen Y, because Gen Y is millennials, Gen X, Gen Y, and then Gen Z, Zoomers. And so then what it comes out of, well, let's start with the Greek letters, but there is something kind of foreboding about that. They're starting a new cycle, but like what does that mean exactly? Like what does that mean? And with generations, like every generation kind of has its cultural events that like that define it. Like if you're a boomer, you know, you remember where you were when Kennedy was shot, and which was most likely school, but you also like, you know, remember like if you were a male, like the anxiety of possibly being drafted for the Vietnam War. If you're Gen X, like you remember where you remember when Kurt Cobain committed suicide. If you're a millennial, you remember when 9/11 happened and you realized we didn't actually live in a safe society, in a safe world anymore, or one that was based on any kind of sanity. I don't know what Zoomers cultural event that's going to mark them is, and that might be the fact that they might not even have one. And that's like that's the point I was getting to, is that I've talked about this with people before, is that when you look at decades, the 50s have a unique culture that people think of. When you think about the 60s, there's a unique culture that people think of. When you think about the 70s, there's a unique culture, style, fashion, like all these things. When you think of these decades, you can think of it. When you think of the 80s, you can think of it. But you'll notice like things start to break down around the 90s. Now, there's still culture. Yeah. There's still culture and fashion that's synonymous with it. So we're not quite there yet. But then let's get to the aughts. Like, what do you think of when you think of the aughts?
If you look at fashion, there's not much distinguishing it, is it?
Yeah, no. And now there are there's certain cultural events that occur. Like there are, like there's always going to be stuff that people remember. But if you'll notice, like what I've always noticed is that, and I noticed this even before I became woke to anything, is that people become nostalgic for things that happened 20 years prior. So the first time you saw this was the 1970s, where there was nostalgia for the 50s, you know, happy days and all that. In the 80s, there was nostalgia for the 60s. In the 90s, there was nostalgia for the 70s. And in the aughts, there was nostalgia for the 80s. Well, when you got to this teen decade, if the cycle had continued, you would have thought there would have been nostalgia for the 90s. And of course, there's always a little bit of nostalgia, but what stayed? What stuck around in terms of nostalgia? 80s. Like, we've been in a perpetual 80s nostalgia for nearly like 10, 15 years now. Mm-hmm. It's like it has been. It just hasn't let up. Synthwave is still popular for a lot of people. People love this kind of, like, they love the aesthetics and the style of it. People aren't advancing nostalgia anywhere past that. And I think that's showing the breakdown of culture more than anything else. And that's what's, like, this is something I've talked about with people. It's like, we are entering a kind of like a sense of like, of timelessness, and not timelessness in the sense of like, oh, like that's a classic now, a sense of timelessness where like we have no sense of time anymore. Like culture's not rooted to a specific time period anymore. Like, and a lot, again, this goes back to technology, because we have easy access to the media and culture of the previous decades. So it all just gets pushed together, mashed together, and you just end up with this brown gloop of society that doesn't, and this is part of the whole atomization and deracination that goes hand in hand with all this. Like, there's nothing that's remarkable about it. There's nothing to remember about it. And people start to like spin off into their own extremely specific identities and subcultures and cliques and the like. There's nothing that's to unify people in any kind of cultural sense anymore. That's rooted to a place in time. Like, this is like everything, when everything exists online, when online is the absolute compendium of everything that we could put into it, there's nothing that's really going to emerge out of that actually unifies people.
Who's behind it? Because you mentioned deracination. This might be a good, and something else we want to talk about is the sort of the destruction of cultural and ethnic roots, and that's all part of sort of this 20th century project of the cult of integration and homogenization of these things. A good example, homosexuality. You mentioned there's such, and also even a smaller group, the so-called transgendered, you know, drag queen types, or there's drag queens and transgender. I don't know, they're mixing these groups, but I'm saying it's such a small percentage of the population.
Yeah.
Yet we have the phenomenon of what's called woke capital, meaning all the Fortune 500 companies are pushing it, and they're pushing it hard, and there's no sign of any real popular demand or support among the general population, the normal people. Yet it's being pushed so hard in the media and entertainment and commercials. Last fall, there was some letter that was signed by, like Chase Manhattan Bank, Dow Chemical, Apple, Microsoft, Hewlett Packard, the list goes on, about their support for transgendered rights and the so-called Equality Act. Now, again, why would big business, which you would think is concerned about mass marketing, appealing to broad appeal, be pushing this agenda? Well, one thing is that, I think you probably agree with me. It's been also observed that this is a way of pushing the ultimate mass consumer society, you know.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I get into – this is like, who's behind it all is a hotly debated topic even among my circles. Like, obviously, we believe that there is a large Jewish element behind this, that they are an ethnic group that's very entrenched in power. They
definitely
have
enormous with pornography. Books. They've written books about it.
Oh, yeah. So. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
They call it progressive and freedom.
And they're also overrepresented in woke capital stuff. Mm-hmm. There is a large Jewish element in this. And I personally think that this is kind of an inevitable problem in an inevitable problem of extremely complex technological capitalist societies, that this is techno-capital at the core. Like, this is, like, again, like, we're going back to the TRS stuff. Like, I tend to be, I think, much more critical of capitalism itself than some of my compatriots are, because I think this is like an inevitable kind of result of many of these factors if it's not controlled. Now, like, for the Jews, because, like, they benefit as, like, being a minority, that it's always like, that's always the minority in any country they're in outside of having their own ethnostate, being that they're always the minority and they tend to, you know, gravitate towards power. It is absolutely in their interest to have a much more diverse society, because, like, when in diverse societies, they just fare better, like, just because, like, there's no single other for people to focus on, especially when things go bad, like, for them to focus their, you know, their ire on. And this is, like, again, this is a pattern that repeats constantly.
Yeah, this is I think McDonald writes about this.
Oh, yeah. Culture critique. I was actually listening. I've been listening to a lecture series on the Ottoman Empire, and the lecturer, maybe I misheard him, but he said, like, at one point that Constantinople under the Ottomans had, like, nearly, like, a 20% Jewish population. Like, they fared, like, either way, like, whatever the actual numbers were, because, like, there was the Jews of Thessaloniki, which was, like, that's a well-known thing. They had a huge community there. But regardless, like, Jews fared extremely well under the Ottoman Empire, which was probably one of the most diverse empires, you know, like, that was a world player at that time. It was an extremely diverse empire, and Jews did very, very well for themselves. And I see a lot of Ottoman Empire parallels in our society, to be honest. That's a little bit of a tangent, because we're talking about woke capital right now. But, like I said, I think a lot of this stuff is just intrinsic to techno-capitalism, because, like I said, the example I was saying with social media earlier, like, social media is predicated on you being the product. You're the product. And in order for you to be able to sell that product, you have to give up bits of yourself to the public. The agreement of social media is that you intrinsically give up your privacy of who you are in order to interact with other people and provide them with that in exchange for dopamine. Now, what people, like, fooled themselves into thinking is that they could have, like, they could be in control of your privacy, when, like, no, it's actually in the interest of the company that's creating this to remove as much of your privacy as possible. That way that they can make money and sell product. Like, that's the whole purpose of, mm-hmm. of them doing that. And that, like, that's, like, a good small scale, like, of why, like, it inevitably comes, like, that woke capital, it may not be the absolute inevitable conclusion. That's a hotly debated top point. I think that's the case. But because the best way to sell product to people, to sell more product to people, is to absolutely break them of any bonds to, you know, to a community, to a place, to, like, any sense of themselves. Like, the more broken you are in terms of your identities, the much more easy it is to find things to buy. Like, now instead of just being, like, a normal person who's, like, living their life, like, now, like, you're a biracial, like, genderqueer person, like, who considers themselves extremely liberal. Well, there's three different identities right there I can sell you products based off of. Like, as I break down your identity, I can keep creating more and more fracturing forms of a market that I can possibly convince you to, you know, spend money on and to pay me for. And because, like, we know that they take this stuff into consideration. Edward Bernays, who was Freud's double nephew, he got to start basically convincing women that smoking was empowering. He worked for advertising. Yes. Like, he's the godfather of all this stuff. Like, he, again, like, double nephew of Sigmund Freud. He basically gave the keys over to companies for psychological manipulation. Like, they
liberty torches.
Yeah, exactly. Cigarettes. This is
you've come, I mean, a long, like, way, the baby.
Oh yeah, it's like. I sound like – I always feel like I'm a crazy person, like, talking about this stuff. But this is stuff that happened. This is stuff that is real. Like, it's – like, a lot of this stuff is just very simple historical record, but people just don't understand the implications of this for the most part. So with the woke capital thing, like, it's completely in their interest to break it apart. But the other element of it is that people without families – and people who, like, are very invested in, like, you know, like, turning in, you know, inwardly, are also the best enforcers of this stuff, because they have nothing else. It's how, like, that's how you get cat ladies in HR.
And yes, it's about to just made me think, yeah, of HR. Yeah,
And you have like the homosexual middle manager who, because he doesn't have like a, you know, a kid's ball game oftentimes to get to, like, he's more willing to put in the hours, and he might even be like more vindictive towards like employees that are more family focused. Now there's always like a give and take with that. Like they're like, they are well aware, like, not to be overly malicious. Well, at least until recently, they knew not to be overly malicious with the stuff lest they give the game away. But it's like there's a great interview on Parallax Optics that I highly recommend people read, where the guy behind the Woke Capital Twitter account basically breaks down this phenomenon, like the catty drama nature makes these people excellent enforcers, especially in internal office politics. And people often forget, like, when people think of like workers' rights and workers' solidarity, they think of like the blue collar guy, you know, with the wrench and like, you know, we're going to unionize and fight. Like, but like people in office jobs like have like, while they don't undergo the arduous or horrific working conditions like, say, miners do, like, they often like the office is basically this incredible feminine environment that's designed to psychologically terrorize people and prevent them from having any kind of solidarity with their own, you know, with their coworkers within the office as well. I've seen it firsthand, having worked in an office, is that it is the more like like, there's nothing more, like, I think, demeaning than business language, because yeah. I've gotten into trouble for trying to speak, I come from a working class, like a blue collar family originally. So I have a particular way of speaking, especially like when I'm a very blunt person. And I've always gotten into trouble for that, because I can't stand this feminine business, you know, office lingo. And they basically, like, and that's why, like, these types of broken people are perfect for these roles. They'll go along with those protocols, then they will enforce them to the T just to get that bit of power over another person. Like, these are like psychopathic environments.
Yeah. And a good example is the stereotypical homosexual has got a strong fashion sense, good fashion sense. And, you know, the stereotypical slob male who doesn't care about his appearance, who's a better consumer?
Yeah. Absolutely.
And, yeah. And, you know, so that there, and also a lot of the political correctness and the tyranny that's being imposed, and also you also see it with the censorship. Now it's being farmed out to human resource departments of various corporations. And this is what my point is do you think it's just a coincidence that all the Fortune 500 companies started to take up the cause of transgenderism?
Yeah.
I mean, obviously there's coordination there, right? I mean, yeah. And it's implemented through the HR. So now you have, you know, sensitivity, tolerance programs. They become promotion programs, because if you don't wear the rainbow shirt on a Thursday in June or something, now you're on the outs, and it'll go in your file and these things, yeah.
And people completely miss, like, and I get it, like, I understand why people go for the surface analysis of this, but they're miss, like, most people, I think, miss the point on all of this, because they'll make one of two cardinal mistakes. They'll think, like, oh, like, look at the, you know, LOL, look at these dumb companies. Don't they know that if you go woke, you go broke? One, that's not true. That's absolutely not true. And it's been shown not to be the case, like, 9 times out of 10.
I'm sure people are buying Gillette razors now.
Yeah, no, well, it's because like when you control the market, like, you get to, like, that's the problem. It's like, when you have these massive companies, like, it doesn't, like, the market's not going to be affected by like them doing this kind of stuff. Like, at this point, I think just because of habit, like, they could literally just have straight up child pornography in their advertisements, and I think they'd probably only take about a 10% hit in their profits at this point. Like, it's just like that's what the control of market.
Yeah, Campbell's Soup. I remember had an ad. Where there was a young boy, and he had two men there, very effeminate looking, and they're doing the Star Wars Luke. It was, I guess, a Star Wars themed Campbell's Soup thing, and they're the Luke, I am your father, shtick, and both of them were saying, I am your father, I am your father. The boy has two fathers. This is just nothing more. I think illustrates just the evil nature of big business.
Yeah. Well, the second cardinal mistake that people make is that they think that the person, like, often viewing this for the first time, it's like, oh, well, they're just being cynical to, like, you know, to a new market. It's like, but that's not like the the quote-unquote pride market, the gay market, is actually not that large of a market. Like, the actual purpose of all of this is control more than anything else. And you stated, like, you stated the perfect example of that, making you wear the pride shirt. Like, this is a malicious tool meant to humiliate people.
Who wasn't who said political correctness is all about humiliation?
I have no idea, but like that's always what it's been about. It's always been like that was like one of the first things that clued me into all of this stuff is like how the words always changed. Because like I used to be a pretty liberal person. I used to be like a committed anti-racist. I was one of those people that policed other people's language and the like. And it was how quickly like the language was changing. Because I was trying to come in I'm trying to be a genuinely good person. I'm trying to be tolerant, understanding. So I was always actually even as well like I was always like more tolerant of people's bigotry. But it's like I'm going to try to educate them kind of thing. But when I saw like how quickly the language was changing that even I was struggling to keep up, that's when I realized like there's something more to this. This is I'm completely wrong about this, and what I'm doing is completely wrong. I really need to stop doing this because this is something's not right here. And that was like one of the things that kind of started me along this path. But
what's the chief function of a corporation? I think overtly, it's there to make money, to return, profit to the stockholders, these things. But I think the covert or the hidden missions of the corporation is, well, it's part of the New World Order, if you will, the groups that actually control things. And the corporation is there to sort of cartelize. In the process of cartelization, they have to make sure that they can expand markets and exert control. And you do that by deracinating and atomizing society, and that's inherently means you have to engage in subversive or activity, and also only semi-covert social engineering is what we're seeing, because I don't think it's covert anymore.
I mean, it's just obvious. Like these people get a kick out of it. Like now, the Jewish element, the malicious part. There's a huge Jewish element in that because of like revenge. I've seen this so many times. I think five of the six major
advertising firms that control commercials we see are Jewish owned.
Yeah. Well, there's a meme about me. For people who listen to the TRS stuff know this meme. Like I don't know what it is about me, and I'll never understand this. Maybe it's just how I look, but I attract a lot of Jewish women. I don't get it. I don't know why. I don't know why they're attracted to me. It's happened too many times though. Like there's got to be some reason for this phenomenon. But the point of me, like, I'm not trying to brag here. What I mean is I've had conversations with them though. Like obviously I've had conversations with them, and like that was my firsthand exposure to like the grudge that they hold. Like I have Russian, like I have Russian ancestry, and specifically, like I have family that were like, if you go like back far enough, like they were Cossacks. And when like, I was just talking to this girl and like just trying to get to know her, like talking about family heritage and like, and I mentioned that, and she gave me the worst like who farted face I've ever seen, and she starts telling me about how her great grandmother was like terrorized by Cossacks, and like this is an experience I've encountered a number of times. Like I have noticed that they tend to have this very comes from their pride of their history. Like they, like Jews are very pride, have a lot of pride about their long history. So they remember all the slights. They remember all the people that they perceive oppressed them and the like. And so when they have power, if they see anybody who's ever been that in their lives or is emblematic of that, they have a very malicious, punitive aspect to them. And I think I genuinely believe like that this drag kid stuff, like this is meant to be like a, like on a some kind of bizarre psychological, like collective psychological level, is a punitive and malicious measure, especially toward like I bet you anything that they're hoping that any kid that encounters this comes from a Catholic family. Like it's
my guess. Leo Pfeffer was a activist Jewish lawyer, First Amendment freedom of religion activist, meaning expunging religion from the public square in the 60s and 70s. He was very successful in his cases, and he took pride in the fact that he created what he called the naked public square, where all religions are equal, meaning that there were no religions, meaning secular humanism reigned. And he talked about this, the way that the popular history treats him as sort of a secularizing liberal progressive, typical liberal progressive Jew, attorney, a lawyer, activist lawyer. But in his memoirs, he would talk about his hatred and bitterness towards the Catholic neighbor that he lived next to. Particularly, he on his way to school and back, the girls lining up in school in their Catholic dresses, and the boys on one side, the girls on the other in their uniforms, all clean cut and orderly, and he hated it.
Yeah.
And that no one talks about that contempt, that racism, if you will, if you want to call it that. You know, but you're right, in many of the narratives of his career, that's not talked about as being a motive force behind his activism.
And this kind of brings us full circle to like where we kind of started on all this with the hardcore is like that, like he looked out his window and he saw like just this nice family minding their own business and this deep seated hatred that I believe just like it's an ethnic thing. I don't know,
a little pathological.
I think it's like a psycho spiritual thing to it as well. But he could not help himself and he burned with hatred for those people and wanted to see them destroyed. Well, like that's why like this whole like I'm going to retreat to my little Western Michigan small town with my nice little Dutch Calvinist church and they'll, you know, you do your thing, I'll do my thing, and we'll just like learn to live with each other. It's like that's not going to happen. Like especially when these people are aligning with pornographers, when they're aligning with, like, you know, it's not just Jews. You have pornographers. Which I know, obviously, Jews and pornographers are like heavily linked. But like, there's pornographers. There's people. Like, there's various people in power. There's capitalists. Like, there's a lot of different interests involved in this, and they're willing to work in alliance in tandem, whether they realize they're doing this or not, to basically destroy everything that they see as their enemy in the world.
I've made this point about pornography. Obviously, you know, it was the publication of Playboy, I think, in 1953. It had the cover of Marilyn Monroe, and who serendipitously became a movie star right after that, big star. And so maybe there was some coordination there for her stardom, you know. Coincidence, if you believe in coincidence, that's fine. But you know, Hugh Hefner was set up, of course. Well, who funded Hugh Hefner in these things? And I like to, most likely this was probably funded, American Jewish Committee and probably the CIA and these things, because they were very involved in public. And we heard about the Congress for Culture of Freedom and all these magazines that came out. It turns out they're all CIA funded, in Time Life, we had Skull and Bones, and at least the Life, the Henry Luce Empire. Normalizing things like teenage pregnancy and the Culture Revolution, promoting all this stuff. So it's all being promoted. But when these magazines were allowed to be published and distributed to the U.S. Mail Service, and they said, well, it's only going to go to subscribers in a brown paper bag.
Yeah.
Okay. Once you make this material and mail it out, how do you control its proliferation? You can't, because I grew up at a very relatively innocent age. By age 9, we were finding dirty magazines hidden in the woods somewhere.
Yeah.
You see? So this is the reality. You can't control its proliferation. So if you can't control its proliferation, don't tell me you're only selling it to adults, which is destructive in and of itself, but it's not, you're not corrupting innocence. You can't control its proliferation.
Yeah, and that's a consequence of technology. Whenever anybody, especially like technophiles, whenever they tell you like, oh, it's not going to do this, or we're going to, this won't happen, they're either dumb or they're lying to you. Like everything that like other than like, you know, like the most alarmist kind of fears, like which is what they often use to kind of like stereotype anybody who's concerned about technology, other than like the most like ridiculous alarmist fears, like any like concern that people have had about technology has basically been vindicated by history. It was like, and a thought that occurred to me, because like this is like the horrifying, like demoralizing aspect of how they apply it, because technology is all what technology ultimately means is control. And like an example, like you take like the Israelis conquering Ramallah during the Second Intifada and them using commandeering the radio waves to basically broadcast pornography into the Palestinian territories as a form of psychological warfare. I mean, it used to be in less technological times. Like, human beings we're a very brutal species. We engage in very brutal, horrific acts, but we had in less technological times, we tried to retain some amount of humanity in in the way we engaged in warfare. Yeah, it was filled with pillaging. Yes, it was filled with rape. You did horrible things to the people you conquered. Like, now, like, all these things are true, but like, there's always been this duality. Like, well, we have to try and retain our humanity in the midst of that. And it's because the technology was much lower. Technology has an effect on your psyche. So as technology, you know, improves and gives you the ability to have more control, the temptation becomes very great to exert more control over your enemy and demoralize and humiliate them and break them in ways that would have never been conceivably possible, like broadcasting pornography into another territory, doing things like this. And then, like, you end up using that to basically, as you're conquering these people, to completely destroy them in every sense of what they are. Like, if you're not, like, outright genociding them, then, like, you're psychologically genociding them, making them unable to ever actually be a normal functioning person.
Yeah, and it sort of it contradicts the sort of the Whig progressive view of history, where these things are liberating. Well, actually, these things are enslaving.
Yeah,
they're used to enslave you, because what they do is they excite the passions, and you become subject to your passions and your base appetites. And a man who doesn't have control of his passions is enslaved to easily manipulate. And that's what we have with, you know, mass society today.
Yeah. This is the stuff that Kaczynski was warning about. And he will remain for a long time an extremely controversial figure, not just because he's a terroristic murderer, but because of, like, what he's talking about in industrial society and its future. Like, when a lot of people, when they read it for the first time, are like, they get that creeping sensation in the back of their heads, you know, crawling up their neck as they they're trying to convince themselves that they're not agreeing with what Kaczynski's saying in this, because he lays it out pretty simply. Like, what technology leads to is lack of autonomy, lack of freedom, because what technology ultimately is used for is to control people and to control large groups of people. And that's the most, like, that is the most obvious thing to use it for. And people, like, get this mistaken notion of, like, well, when they think of technological control, they think of, like, a 1984 CCTV on every corner kind of thing, which, of course, UK is already there. And that's, mm-hmm. that does happen. But the control that is the most terrifying of all is the control of your reality. Like, that's you begin to love Big Brother, but it's not Big Brother you actually need to be worried about. It's Little Brother.
Yeah.
Little Brother was the one that you weren't looking out for.
Here's an example of that. And maybe this is a good way to move on kind of in the conversation about America's demographics and the supposed racial issues and the future of the country with immigration and the supposed browning of the country, what that portends. But there is and this goes to political correctness, and there was a student, I guess he was a student at Parkland High School, who was accepted into Harvard.
Oh, Kashev, yeah.
And the application, his acceptance was rescinded because when he was 16 years old, he apparently either typed or used the word nigger online. And now Harvard says he cannot go to Harvard. Harvard says he's not, Harvard material. He was 16 years old.
I might have a different, like, slightly different position on this than you, because this actually, it's not the hypocrisy of political correctness that this is highlighted for me. Like, it's the hypocrisy of Jewishness, because Kashev, the kid you're talking about, Kashev, he's a Jewish kid himself, and he had conservatives rallying to his defense in terms of, like, oh, he was just a kid. Like, I actually agree with what they're saying.
Yeah.
But the thing is, like, these people, like, what Kyle Kashev said, like, the kind of, like, language he was talking about and the things he was saying, it was far worse than somebody like Jared Taylor, who's never has ever said it. And nobody, like, these conservatives, these hypocritical conservatives, never rallied to his defense. For me, like, there's no dog in this race. I get the point of, like, you know, like, they're going after, like, they, you know, they're going after a kid for speech, for, you know, uncouth things he said, you know, like, and I agree with the principle of being able to, like, you know, a free speech. I absolutely 100% agree with it. So, like, I agree with that. But, like, to me, this also just highlights that, like, if, you know, that conservatives will, like, conservatives have an extremely philo-Semitic bent to them, and that is not a controversial thing to say in the least bit. Like, conservatives in America are hugely philo-Semitic, and they may not even realize to the extent that they are sometimes, because
Jews killed them Arabs.
Well, I'm sure a lot of conservatives are when they rally to Kashif's defense, like, they're not doing it for that reason. Like, they don't realize this has been the dichotomy that's been set up for them, because they've been browbeaten to not come to the defense of somebody like Jared Taylor. But then, like, Kashif, he's framed like, it's like, oh, he's just a kid. He's just a kid who said some dumb things when he was younger. Like, oh, our politically correct society's run amok. Like, how, like, you know, let him apologize. Let him, like, make amends for that. Like, this has been framed for them in a certain way that's, like, what they go for without actually – they don't rally to the defense of actual ideas, and not just ideas, actual facts. That's the terrifying aspect of it all to me.
Well, a good example is how the establishment right or the corporate conservatism – had nothing to say about what happened in Charlottesville and Unite the Right rally, which was set upon by Antifa.
The only person I saw, Ann Coulter. It's no secret that we're big Ann Coulter fans. Ann Coulter is she's the only principled person, like, with that could be, like, said to be, like, anywhere close to kind of, like, mainstream. And, like, I mean, she's taken so much heat and damage to her own career for standing up for, like, especially, like, with the Trump stuff where she turned on Trump. Like, she has taken, like, such a beating. Like, she gave it all up for Trump, basically, and this is, like, it has shattered her career in many respects.
Yeah, because, it was. Yeah, she wrote the book, right? What was that book? Yeah.
In Trump We Trust.
In Trump We Trust. Then she writes Adios America.
it was reportedly, now, like, we're beginning to do our own, like, on TRS, we're kind of doing our own revisionism of Trump, like, looking back, it's like, mm-hmm. where we had this whole time. I'm not gonna like I don't really, it doesn't really matter, like, but allegedly, like, it was like Adios America that, like, had, like, informed Trump's immigration policies, or, like, what his promised immigration policies were going to be, you know. So, and it was Ann Coulter who was on Bill Maher drawing absolute mocking laughs, like, when she said that Trump, like, way back when the election first started, like, that of all the Republican candidates, the person who would have the best chance of winning would be Trump. Like, she was vindicated completely in her support of Trump, and then, like, he basically stabbed her in the back. And it breaks my heart to see something like that, where she put her faith in, you know, in that guy, and to have him, like, become President Kushner, and her, like, get nothing out of that, like, to basically just be, like, to have her, you know, her reputation tarnished. It's just a sad thing to see. That's the absolute state of conservatism.
Well, because I don't think electoral politics, particularly at the national level, that is a practical way to address these things.
I agree 100%.
We're living in an occupied society.
Absolutely.
You know,
absolutely.
You know, and I know it's, you know, I guess I was happy to see Trump win over Hillary Clinton, but I haven't voted in a presidential election since 2000. So, you know,
smarter than the rest of us were.
Yeah. You know, so I was like, you know, I did vote in a primary for Ron Paul one time, but Ramsey Paul, I guess you're familiar with Ramsey Paul.
Yeah, I'm familiar with him.
He had an interesting about a 26-minute pod program called The Future of America, and he's talking about how demographics are changing the country. And he had this little chart that he drew up, and you can watch it. He just drew it with his own pen. It's rather crude, but it's effective. And the effects of immigration, the demographic changes, the ethnic changes in ethnic makeup of America, the decline of heritage America or European America or white America, and what that portends. And I guess to express any concern about that is to be a neo-Nazi, nationalist, I guess any concern about this. They usually throw these terms out. But basically he drew out what California as an example. And it basically what you have is you have California used to be a conservative state, with a political and economy that was somewhat sustainable, normal. But California didn't go crazy because the people changed. although that there has been some cultural change in the past, you know, 40, 50 years. But basically, it's immigration. There's new people, different people.
Yep.
And you had the now it's now majority Latino, not majority, you know, white, you know, heritage European American, and you've had immigration increase, which then produces an effectively a one party state, Democratic Party in California. This inevitably leads to a rejection of the Constitution or constitutional ideas or so-called American ideals. Hence, you get hate speech and gun control laws. And this inevitably leads to economic and legal warfare against dissidents and ultimately societal decline. And we're kind of seeing that with America, where America is now just a little less than two-thirds European extraction or background or white Americans. And it was recently in the 1970s, close to 90%. We do know these changes have been sought after. In fact, Mark Potok at the Southern Poverty Law Center, in an interview, I know you might have seen this, where he had a chart.
It was my friend Mitch Hoop was the one who actually, I think, was the first one that noticed that. Yeah, I think he was the one, like, he was the one whose tweet went viral. I know that. Yeah, he's the one who noticed that.
Yeah, and so they're charting it for a reason, and we are told. I think Time Magazine did a cover of this, how the browning of America, America's changing complexion is going to change a different culture, different politics. And I think it was there's a law professor, Adam Winkler, I think out of UCLA, a while back penned an article talking about this, about National Rifle Association. And I forget which election cycle it was. It might have been 2016 or 2014, but basically this was an election cycle where the Republicans did well. And a lot of it was a result of the National Rifle Association and concern for gun rights. And he says, while this recent election was a victory for the National Rifle Association, it doesn't look good in the long term because of demographics. And he pointed out the fact that, you know, as America becomes more urban, more non-white, meaning Latino, Black, even Asian, these groups don't have the same regard for the First Amendment and much less and the wider Constitution as white people do. Basically, the Constitution is a white thing. So as America becomes less white, the Constitution will lose its support among the people, and we can look forward to profound changes politically in the country. If that is indeed the case, that white decline in the country does portend a change in the nation's politics and policies, then the other side is true. Then, though, if you don't like those changes, then you should advocate for reversing demographics and increasing the white population, either through increased childbirth or restrictive immigration. But to take that position, they admit the argument. But to take that position, you're decried as a racist.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I mean, with Potok, I mean, coincidentally Jewish is just coincidence right there, but and I mean, you brought up something you mentioned that I don't actually hear guys talk about. I mean, like, it's like might be mentioned in passing, but it made me think of something. We're talking about people going into the cities, because it's not just immigration. I mean, like, it's not just the act of immigration going in there and changing the demographic phase. That's a huge element. Don't get me wrong. Like, that's an element that I'm deeply concerned about. But like you mentioned, everybody like being pushed into cities. Mm-hmm. Like that's a form of deterritorialization. And people, I would ask people to ask themselves, why are they pushing people into cities? There's a lot of reasons for that. You can probably think of a couple yourself. Like, why would they? Why, I mean, like, there is that phenomenon that people in the cities tend to be more liberal. There is the phenomenon of like that people in the cities tend to move like more towards either being homosexual or being more accepting of homosexuality. It's like there is that level of complexity that happens to the human mind when they go into the cities, but it's deterritorialization. Like, the more, like, if you want to exert control over people, and especially if you want to like have more freedom to control the face of a nation, you have to deterritorialize people, because the most dangerous thing is to have a people that have a sense of blood and soil, to be rooted in land. This is a dichotomy I've seen a couple times in the dissident right, and I have to be very careful of how I talk about it, because I don't mean to lord this over people. Like, I feel incredibly mean if I ever do this. I try to be very careful about what I say, but like I encounter a lot of people who are urbanites or I mean, I'm technically an urbanite myself, but like the people who have, like, they've either moved around or they don't really have a lot of friends where they live, or like they aren't like they have a family that like maybe like they know their parents and, you know, obviously their siblings and the like, but like they come from like a breaking down nuclear family kind of thing. Like I come from a like my family has lived in Michigan for over six generations. I mean, there's a number of different, like depending on which side of the family you're talking about, because I come from a different number of different immigrant groups, but my family's lived in Michigan for over six generations. Like they've been here since before it was a state. And I can go to a graveyard and I can point to, you know, various graves of people like that. I'm descended from that person, or like this, you know, this is, I may not have, like, I didn't know this person, this like my this great grandparent of mine, but like this is where they reside. I know who they are. I know their name. I know all that stuff. Like I live in a place where, because like a lot of people didn't move out of it, I know my second cousins. I know my third cousin. I don't even know a couple of my third cousins. I know my great uncles. Like I have an extremely large extended family that I'm acquainted with more than like, oh, I see these people like one, maybe once a year at like Christmas dinner or something. I have a deep sense and connection to the state of Michigan. Like I've moved around before and I've gone overseas for work, but like, this is like, the question is like, can I leave this place has often come up, especially in the context of my politics. And I often struggle with that. Like, I don't think it's possible for me because I'm too rooted in this land. There's too many people here I'm connected with. And I do feel like this deep, like even when I leave the state and I come back, like I just like, there's this wave of relief that washes over me. Like, this is my home. And a lot of people don't have that, and that's ultimately what they want, because when they deterritorialize people, put them into the cities, it's so much easier to control them, it's so much easier to do whatever they want with them, and it's so much easier to absolutely change the demographic face of this country. Because if they have to start dealing with a bunch of people that are extremely clannish and extremely preferential to their own, they're going to encounter a lot of resistance, and what they don't want is resistance.
Yeah, it was a time in the cities, you had ethnic neighborhoods, and you, just because mm-hmm. you lived in the city, you did have ethnic yep. roots, but those are destroyed.
Yeah, Slaughter Cities, E. Michael Jones.
The combination of FHA, the interstate highway system, and, of course, racial integration, which was never, the goal was never integration. The goal was to create white flight into suburbia, where you would be deracinated, and you become sort of this vanilla white American, as opposed to an Irish American. But even Michael Jones says that, you know, what you had in America was a triple melting pot, where an Irish girl would marry a German guy, or an Italian girl would marry an Irish guy, and it sort of what they'd lose their ethnic identity, but they were Catholic. And of course then suburbia would take care of that eventually.
You can look at my family for that.
Yeah. So you have this sort of this deracination that's occurring at the same time they're promoting this cult of integration. And it's being promoted as being very progressive and just, this the civil rights era in these things. And, you know, for most Americans and for the longest time, I believe, too, that there was that, you know, that the country's minority, the black Americans, deserved a place at the table. They have their basic civil rights and they shouldn't be discriminated against in these things. But it was easily weaponized. And we saw that relatively soon, actually, right after the Civil Rights Revolution. But what's happened now is,
The great tragedies of the black self-determinists, the blacks that wanted self-determination, were absolutely 100% right, and they were the ones who should have been supported, not the integrationist.
Yeah, ones. This would be like Marcus Garvey and
Malcolm X and the like. Yeah, like they absolutely should have been like, and I'm just one guy, but I if that were the situation, I would have been happy, like, because of like the original sin of bringing them over here as slaves. Like, I wouldn't have mind. Like, I think at this point, a lot of people would have no problem with it if they had to like financially at least support it a little bit as it built it, like as like a little black kind of like nation or nation within a nation, however it had to work. Like, if it meant like able to have like desegregated societies, I think if it meant like having to actually like financially support it, at this point, I think people would wildly go for that. But unfortunately, I think that ship has sailed.
Well, what we've had now with America is you can actively talk about, you know, the declining white population and sort of the browning of America, which would suggest is you're encouraging white displacement, but at the same time they're denying white identity, and they're able to do that because, you know, white identity is kind of fragile because it's a negative identity. You're white in relation to someone who isn't white, you know, so it can be very easily be marginalized and pushed aside in these things. But with the triple melting pot theory is, in a sense, you do sort of get a white consciousness, you know, because you're no longer a German or an Irish, but you are Caucasian, European, and Heritage America is a European, you know, artifact. It's a product of European culture, its political system, and to the extent that's worth preserving, it's a European artifact. As it becomes less and less European, do you think, its institutions aren't going to be supported, and that's suggested in articles like by Mr. Winkler and Mark Potok, is that these institutions that we think that are so sacred, to the extent they even follow it at all, but they won't be anymore. That's why you have no concern for free speech and free expression. It becomes rule of the mighty and these things, but. There's a certain, I was reading an article. It's about, I think the House Judiciary Committee was voting on a bill to create a commission to investigate, look into the reparation payments for descendants of slaves.
Oh, yeah.
And there was an article by John Derbyshire, and he wrote a piece. He said, the House Judiciary Committee hearings on a bill to, wait a minute, let me get this precisely right, a bill to create a commission that would make recommendations concerning any form of apology and compensation to descendants of enslaved African Americans was the congressional clown show of the week. That's the bill, to create a commission to make recommendations. Reminds me of my days as a student union debater when we had fun with Robert's Rules of Order, moving a motion to move the motion that the motion is now tabled. Anti-racism is now a mating display. It says, look at me. I have such earning power. I can live where I like. I don't have to worry about the feral underclass blacks or the Salvadorian gangbangers. I can strike a pose of lofty indifference to the matters of race. Drop your knickers right now. In fact, a couple of blacks, Coleman Hughes and a former NFL player, Burgess Owens, showed up at the hearings to argue against reparations as demeaning the blacks, as carrying the implication that unless whites give them stuff, they can't cope. You've made them into a victim. There's an article there. The moment you give someone reparations, you made them into a victim in real clear politics. Which is the point of fact true. When whites are driven out, as in Detroit or in Zimbabwe, or killed off, as in Haiti, the blacks end up with Haiti, Zimbabwe. Without whites, blacks really can't cope. That's a hard thing for the talented 10th blacks like those two dissenters at Wednesday's hearing to admit, and I intend no offense to them personally. They both seem like fine, smart American gentlemen, but the untalented 9/10 is a mighty burden to bear, too much for the talented 10th to manage. Whites have their own feckless, troublesome underclass, too. I know. I grew up among some of them. That's the sack we have to drag, but there aren't so many that we can't manage them, though, and make progress in spite of them. Blacks have a different equation to solve. White Americans have done their best to help the blacks solve it. We've done more than that. In fact, we've distorted our entire social system, twisted our laws, spent trillions of dollars to help them, affirmative action, contract set-asides, hiring favoritism, exquisitely punctilious protocols and speech and writing to avoid offending them, gibberish college courses for them to be professors of, strict media silence for levels of black crime, fake documentaries presenting black thugs as rapists and as saintly victims. Yeah. Sorry. Yeah.
America's inability to deal with its original sin, the NQ, the Negro question, mm-hmm. has unleashed a cavalcade, a Pandora's box of just demographic horrors upon us. Because once reparations gets underway at some point, like I don't know, like it's more like a political football at mm-hmm. this present time, but it's going to happen. I mean, like along the current trajectory, it'll happen. And And then once that occurs, then it opens everything up to where it's just going to be that they're going to, you know, try to squeeze as much blood from a stone as they can out of white people. It's like people need to understand. And this is the problem, like, of what happens, like, when you have, like, an education system such as ours, is that people either don't know or just forget, like, that. Now, in addition to pornography being a weapon, demography is also a weapon. And it's always been that case, whether intentionally or unintentionally. I mean, one of the things that helped precipitate the fall of the Western Roman Empire was the barbarian invasions, and you had, like, people like the Huns basically get pushing the Germanics deeper into Roman territory. So now the Romans, because they were fleeing another invading force. Now the Romans have to deal with these new people that are entering their territory, and all the growing pains that resulted from that helped create the infrastructure cracks that ended up bringing down the Western Roman Empire over time. I mean, it was one of many issues, but whether it's done intentionally or oftentimes it even happens unintentionally, diversity of peoples is ultimately a weapon that can always be used to undermine solidarity and to basically break, wrest control from one group of people and give it to another. It's like that's been the case, and that's the mindset The problem is, like, people often think in very moralistic terms. It's a fine, good thing to be a moral person, especially like you want your own children to be fine, moral mm-hmm. people. But like, you kind of have to have this cold, calculating perspective on this at times, because that's how they view this as well. They view demography as a weapon. They view these things as basically cudgels to beat and beat and cajole white people to basically draw as much money and power and prestige from them as they can. And until people kind of see it for what it is, the problem is, like, this is the conservative problem. They try too often to view it in moral terms. Like, oh, they're doing an immoral thing. It's like, okay, but maybe that's the case. Maybe they are doing an immoral thing. Are you going to stop them? Can you even stop them? That's the way people need to look at this stuff.
Yeah, there's a certain, if the situation, I think situation is tenable or sustainable if you have a proportions that are sustainable. An 85%, majority that is confident, not stricken with guilt, and could extend a hand and be tolerant towards a minority.
Yeah.
Several minorities. But by flooding the West, but Europe in particular, but the United States is a different example, because you can't appeal to to Frenchmen, the Germans, to Poles. And we see actually more resistance in Hungary and Poland because they have that ethnic identity, that national identity. America is sort of it's been described as sort of a Freemasonic Frankenstein monster, and I agree with that.
It's like, where's the lie though?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, exactly. And, America, I think America's always had its oligarchy, its oligarchs, wanting to control things, and it became feasible in the latter half of the 19th century. Now we have a situation where, it's hard to look at today's situation. You have to look at the situation and put in the context of decades of social engineering and psychological warfare. We didn't get here, naturally or by free choice. I mean, people were forced together.
Yeah,
and that's never a good thing. A good example is when Brown versus Board of Education of Topeka, Kansas, that ruling. Okay, a stupid, hokey, no legal thinking at all, but yet, it was outcomes based, activism, judicial activism. It didn't overturn Plessy v. Ferguson. Plessy v. Ferguson, separate but equal, still stands. But what it did say was, separateness is never equal. Therefore, we have to integrate at all due speed, all deliberate speed, I think was the term. But the problem is schools were segregated based on counties and where people lived. So when the schools didn't segregate fast enough because people tended to live separately, they started enforcing busing. It never ends. Then you're forcing people together. And then when people resisted this, they're the ones that are, characterized as the evil people, the Southies in Boston forcing people to go to school next to people they have nothing in common with, or it ignores the problems of these things. Good example is Boston. Boston's school system was never recovered from it.
Yeah. And I think people need to like remember like there's a couple like you have this virus of liberal democracy for one, and there's too many myths surrounding by it that people like actually start to believe like in the midst of like the efficacy of liberal democracy. But there's like there's this tendency, and obviously like, and it's because of the way they teach history, but there's this tendency to view kind of like things that happened in history as things that just happened. Mm-hmm. Like often without like a context or reason for it, or like that the reason's different from what the actual reason was. Because like when it comes to like civil rights, obviously like with like Brown v. Board of Education, like they're much more open about the fact that this was like, you know, that they were basically shopping, you know, to get like, you know, the case and verdict they wanted to end this policy. But a lot of people don't like know the history behind Plessy v. Ferguson, because that was also like a civil rights attempt that actually backfired on them. On the people that Plessy was representing, because like I said, like the Negro question has always been kind of like the original sin of America. What people don't like, I would encourage people to go Google a picture of Homer Plessy and see what he looks like. He was only an eighth black. He was an octoroon. He looks pretty white when you look at that picture. And it's because of like America's relationship with race. They were basically trying to do this as their own kind of protest against the absurdity of like the separate but equal aspects of race politics, especially in the South. This case happened in New Orleans, which has always had like, which has been a unique place in the United States because of its French influence, which gave rise to a different class of people who were called free people of color. They were generally a much more mixed race class that kind of straddled between the free, you know, between whites and then the enslaved black class, and then later on like who ended up becoming, you know, freed slaves themselves. But like the free people of color have always like straddled this weird racial political angle in the country. Well, this was like their kind of way of like kind of like trying to confront this issue with Plessy v. Ferguson, and it backfired on them because it upheld separate but equal as a possible, as something you could do across the country, and it was implemented across the country. Brown v. Board of Education was their revenge on Plessy v. Ferguson backfiring so badly on them.
Yeah, but again, what you have is you have the specter, or at least the shadow of social engineering.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
I mean, this and again, it's not there to. It's not the integration was not that integrated. It was there to atomize, mm-hmm. and society. I mean, if you can afford it, people segregate.
Yeah,
right.
Democracy is a weapon.
Yep. Yeah, and so now we're seeing now is the inability, because if you can't maintain a community, an ethnic community, and that way you can't maintain your traditions, your culture, which results in an atomization, which the globalists want.
Yeah.
And we're seeing that in Europe, you know, how Germany is a great example of this. You know, they were crushed, defeated, occupied. And they're demonized, the narrative coming out of the Second World War. And so there's no way for a German to express any ethnic or racial identity without being accused of being a Nazi. So Germany's defeated, invaded, crushed. The cities are flattened. Millions starved to death in the immediate post-war era. Then all of a sudden the West decides they need West Germany. They build it up. It becomes the economic powerhouse. But the moment they instituted the currency reforms, the money started flowing in. They started pumping in pornography.
Yep.
And this is there to demoralize, to sexually corrupt, you know, the post-war generation, which inevitably leads to sort of leads to the depopulation, the declining birth rates, the demoralization of German society now. So it's softened up where now they can make the case, well, we need extra labor. You really can't be a proud German. In fact, we encourage you to have sex with foreigners, foreign brown people. The German Ministry of Health actually issues pamphlets with sort of graphic, not graphic, but, you know, the sort of the art you see in pamphlets where it shows a brown man on top of a blonde white woman.
Yeah.
And they're encouraging this. They're not like saying, well, we're laissez-faire, we don't care about it. They're encouraging that.
Well, I'll show you where it's trickling down. I don't believe that the story is real. Like, I think this was made up for the book. But even if it were real, like, it completely goes to my point, because, like, this is, like, how propaganda functions. There's white, you probably heard, you and your audience have probably heard the term white fragility by now. Mm-hmm. Like, it's this, like, their new thing to basically break you down and to make you afraid to speak your mind, and to, you know, and being afraid, you know, to be even more afraid of being considered a racist by taking it to brand new psychological forms of browbeating. Well, in her book, White Fragility by Robin DiAngelo, she's the one who coined the term white fragility. She's the one woman behind all of this stuff in terms of the white fragility stuff. She recounts, because, like, what her thing is that she goes around the country doing seminars, largely in workplaces, going back again to the woke capital thing. Like, she goes there to basically psychologically terrorize normal white people and basically explain to them, like, how they have all this privilege that they don't understand in the least bit. And this is, like, all the, like, hidden ways you do racist things throughout the entire day. And then if you get upset at being called a racist, because, as we know, like, that's like being called accused of witchcraft in, like, mm-hmm. during, like, the witch purges of the medieval times. Like people know racist means witch, so of course we're going to be terrified when you, like, there's any indication that you might be racist. Again, going back to the way that they changed the meaning of words. But she recounts the story of a German woman that was at this workplace that during one of her seminars, who got really upset about, like, being considered racist. And they described this woman as having blonde hair and blue eyes. And she's getting really upset about this because she can't be racist, because, like, when she was a little girl in Germany, they had American soldiers who were stationed there, and they were black men. And she was describing, like, how beautiful she thought they were. And I'm reading this, it's like, this is a bunch of BS. Like, this is a story that didn't happen. But even if it did happen, like, this is their implanting these narratives of basically of putting that in mind, like, of what you're talking about, like, with the sex brochures, mm-hmm. of the interracial sex brochures. Like, they're in every way possible, they're trying to implant this idea into your head, again, to break down demographics, to basically just remove. I mean, like, I think they're not going to stop after white people, but at the present time, they're working on white people.
Yeah. And how else to do it other than just, well, this gets into kind of what you and Nick were talking about in Hardcore is, this is very basic. It's very,
yeah.
Is the men have to realize that their responsibility is to protect their women.
Yeah.
And I'm using that language carefully. Meaning that we've gone to a point where men no longer think, or they're told that they shouldn't protect their women. They don't have their women, meaning that there's no ethnic group. But that, I mean, that could once counter to thousands and thousands of years of human history. Because the one thing that happens when you lose a war is the invaders come in and take your women. That happened to Germany.
Well, there's another example I'll give you that actually is even, like, because, like, when people think of a war, they think of actual violence, and then, like, the conquering and the like, and then, like, mm-hmm. the women are conquered. Well, there's I'm trying to remember what the name of the battle was. This is, like, very early on in Islam, back when I believe this was recounted in the Quran. So this is, like, when Muhammad was still doing his conquests. And there's a famous battle where basically, like, nobody really died. Like, there's only, like, the casualties, like, were, like, could be counted on two hands, because it was a psychological battle more than anything else. It was a battle of tactics, of one side trying to outmaneuver the other. And Muhammad and his followers ended up winning the battle. And what was done to the prisoners was, like, all the men were killed and all the women were taken, and it's a story about an actual tribe. That tribe was completely genocided from history.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it was a psychological battle that ended up resulting in actual violence, but it was a battle of the mind. It was a battle of wits, basically a battle of tactics, and that's what we're undergoing right now. Like, this is, like, people. And I always put these things in war terms, because this is warfare that's going on. It's just warfare by other means. Politics is warfare by other means. Culture is warfare by other means. And they're engaging in that, and the ultimate goal is basically like to get the exact results if you engaged in a violent war, but doing it in the least violent way possible. Mm-hmm. So like this is like people like balk at the idea of interracial propaganda as being a form of warfare. Like they'll try to pathologize you as being hung up about it, or like you know, having some kind of neurosis about it. But that is literally what they're doing. I mean, like, it's been noted that. Again, we go into the Jewish element of this. Like, interracial pornography is one of the most pushed elements of pornography, and it's the least profitable one. But they're relying upon saturation. Like, it's, and again, goes to saturation. This is embodying every minute of your waking existence if you're plugged into technology. Like, if you're on the internet for any given amount of time, you will most likely run into pornography, and you will likely run into interracial pornography at some point in your life. Now you're seeing, like I said, like, you know, you read a book like White Fragility, like you have notions like of interracial pornography implanted into your head. Like, you go to Europe, and where you have the migrant crisis, they actually literally give out interracial pornography instructions of how to do. It's like, this is warfare. Just because people are not out there shooting guns at each other trying to conquer territory, do not think for a moment that you're not involved in a war right now.
And if it doesn't matter, why is it being pushed? And I'm getting to the point, even normies are now picking up on it.
Yeah.
You know, what's this? Every time I turn around. And you know, it's kind of funny because the coupling, the black male, white female coupling is the most rare, but it's the most promoted.
Yep.
And if you look at the statistics, and you can push this stuff and push this stuff. And again, it rubs against our liberal sensibilities because most of us like to think of ourselves as liberal and tolerant. We don't like being put in a position of telling people, you know, who they should date, who they should marry, who are we to tell these things? But this goes to the idea that none of us belong to a community with a responsibility to an ethnic community, roots in a community. In the past, people would have responsibility, a sense of obligation to their people. You know, but they want to do away. So if you're atomized, you have no sense of ethnic identity to preserve an ethnic identity. In fact, if you express that in any way, you're called a racist, which is the worst thing ever. Which is a trick, sort of neurolinguistic programming, a psychological trick in and of itself. Because there's nothing wrong with expressing in-group preferences in how we live, whether it's who we marry, who we decide to associate with, even who we decide to work with, and who we decide to live next to. I mean, who are they to tell us who we have to live next to?
Yeah.
But they presume that right, and they presume it from a position of moral superiority, which is, you know, if you think about it, is absurd.
Yeah, which is why I think people need to like read stuff like The Power of the Powerless by Vaclav Havel, because we talk about being under an occupied government. Mm-hmm. And that's what the dissidents like in Soviet Czechoslovakia were living under. They were living under an occupied government, and they had to live as such. And what Havel always talks about is living. He always talked about living within the truth. And this is something that Mike Enoch has said before. Something he said like on a Strike and Mike episode a while back. That's always stuck with me, is like conservatives tend to have this very defensive mindset of of trying to qualify themselves when they try to have these thoughts. And even people like on the dissident right always act like, you know, we say things like, oh, I'm engaging in wrong think. And I know we're doing it ironically, but like irony has its own inherent mm-hmm. problems. But like, we act like we're doing a bad thing. It's like, no, like you have the right, like free speech is not a crime. Like, you have the right to assert yourself as a member of good standing in society just because you believe different things. You have a right to do that. And, you know, like they're not only are you not wrong, but they're the bad guy. And like, you have to act like that. Like, instead of like, people have, and I understand where it comes from, but like, people have to stop having this defensive mindset. Like, people have to be more assertive. I brought this up recently on Third Rail, but like the Ash experiment shows that people are more confident to say the things that they believe if there's another person there that's asserting it.
Yeah. Yeah. And yeah, you know, the hypocrisy strikes me because whenever I hear someone making the claim, you know, saying that, you know, maybe, you know, I don't believe in integration. I believe in some form of segregation, having your communities of the same group and these things. Well, you're a racist. And so, well, if you can afford to, people who can afford to do that. I mean, they'll say things like, I like to live in a nice neighborhood with good schools, yeah. low crime. Well, what does that mean? What are they really saying?
Well, what I would recommend is like to put them back on the defensive, because like we spend too much time qualifying ourselves, yeah. and I think we have to go on the attack as well. So when they say you're racist, like you say, like, I'm not racist, you're anti-white. Because yeah. they often freak out at that because they're not ready for it, for one, and they know it's true about themselves, so they have to start qualifying themselves.
Yeah, yeah, and well, it's I was listening to an interview with Mike Enoch, and it was in a debate. And someone said, I guess they're querying him on his white nationalism, mm-hmm. white identity, I guess you could say. And they say, would you rather live next to a white oh, yeah. heroin addict or Thomas Sowell?
Yeah, the Tom Sowell argument, one of our favorite ones.
You know, he goes, well, first of all, you're picking two outliers. You know, if every black were like Thomas Sowell, there wouldn't be an issue. I wouldn't be debating with you. And if you know, so that's not a realistic, you know.
Yeah. Well, the answer to that is I don't want to live in a deracinated society where I have to choose between those two.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, the fact you get to justify it was a time when someone, I mean, any other group, if you went to a Chinese guy and said, you're a racist, and they'd say, well, what's that? Or so what?
Yeah.
You know, it's like, so what? And we're still, this is, you know, 40, this is 50, 60 years of social engineering and psychological warfare, pounding in our heads that any ethnic consciousness among Caucasian Americans is evil. Because you're white, you know, and so bad that, you know, in the latter half of the 1960s, they sent Martin Luther King up north into Chicago to integrate. I mean, he's from the South. He knows nothing what's going on in Chicago, you know. But yeah, I think the Rockefellers paid him $20,000 to go up there to agitate in Chicago. He went in his name, he knew nothing what was going on. And he's telling Lithuanians that they're white.
Yeah, if you don't think that they'll if you think they'll stop with us, I mean, like, look to the fact that they put, like, there's often a push as well on white male Asian female relationships, and the offspring of that HAPAs often have like a lot of there's a whole really sad subreddit for HAPAs that, like, where they kind of talk about their identity issues over it. But like after they're done with us, those mixed race offspring are going to be used as a battering ram to deconstruct the Asian nation.
Yes,
they're already working on it with Japan. Jake Adelstein, who's mm-hmm. a Jewish journalist who works in lives in Japan. He's got a Japanese wife. He's got mixed race children, and a frequent target of ire for me and another guy who lives in Japan. As we tend to go after Jake quite a bit, but I mean, his whole thing is he lives there, and all he's ever doing is pushing that Japan needs to accept more immigrants and needs to accept more mixed race people.
Isn't that rude?
Yeah, and he's like, he's doing this like under the pretense like he wants a society that reflects his daughters more, but that's the whole purpose of some of this stuff is basically to get that foothold in there. And then once they're done with us, like, these little traps they're beginning to set for Asia, which have also, like, many of them have fallen for like liberal democracy virus and all that, are going to be they're gonna tear through them. I bring up the liberal democracy thing because, like, the one country that was ever able to really, like, actually manage being multiracial and multicultural in any realistic and significant way is Singapore, and it's because of one man alone, Lee Kuan Yew.
It's authoritarian.
Yeah. Yeah, he created it in a uniquely authoritarian state. Actually, like, his party, the People's Action Party. I recommend people look at the symbol for it. It looks like, it's actually really hilarious, because it looks like kind of like Oswald Mosley's like symbol for his party. It looks a lot like it. And then when you look at the one opposition party that Singapore has, which is Singapore is basically a one party state. Lee Kuan Yew's son has been prime minister since for quite some time now. But the opposition party is like it's kind of like a social democracy party, but it looks like a communist symbol, but it's just a weird looking toy hammer instead. It's a very bizarre. It's a very bizarre thing to see, but I mean, Singapore has a, like, basically it's 75% Han. For people who don't know, Singapore is 75% Han Chinese. Its next minority group is the Malaysians at 15%, who are Muslim. And then you have also the indigenous ethnic group of the island originally and are recognized as such. And then the next largest group are the Indians at about 8%. And then, like, it's a bunch of other foreigners after that. But, like, the Singapore requires for, like, you know, like, Singapore has a bunch of stuff in place to, induce more social harmony. Like, they manage the demographics so that the – especially because, like, much like, just like with white people, like – Asians, when they get to, like, much more technologically kind of advanced society, like, Asians actually always have generally had less kids anyways, but, like, they have to manage their Chinese birth rate in Singapore. But they also, in order to maintain stability with the indigenous Malaysian population there, and it's because, like, they've had race riots there before, like, Lee Kuan Yew basically did his, like, unique authoritarianism on it, is that they're required to have the Malaysians are required to be represented at some level within the society and government. In fact, their current president is a Malaysian Muslim woman who had no opposition because she was the only candidate that qualified, because they were required to allow a Malaysian be the president this time around.
And okay, then after so her, it's based on ethnic, yeah.
Yeah, but after her turns up, it's going to revert back to the Han Chinese. Like, that's the thing. It's like, they manage it where they try to make everybody happy in a very strict way, but making sure that that people feel some kind of representation. Now, is that going to last forever? I don't know, but it stands, Lee Kuan Yew turned a third world country into a first world country in a single generation. He did something amazing with that, and he started with the absolute understanding that liberal democracy would destroy his country because, as he said, like, in a multiracial country, like, democracy is a head count. He understood that completely, and he put as many things into the country as he could to try and mitigate these problems. Will Singapore continue to do so, especially because, like, these entities are trying to democratize the entire world? We will find. Well, I guess we'll see. But, I mean, like, Singapore is the only model for, like, a truly multiracial country that has ever shown any function, any, like, actual way of working in a functional way.
Yeah, with the United States, obviously, how it started out as a sort of a confederation of independent states that had come together for the purposes of mutual defense and sort of a common market. It never really, at least the original design, wasn't to have a federal government run everything and decide everything and micromanage society and engage in social engineering and these things. So it's become more problematic as America became more consolidated in the 20th century. And it becomes more problematic as demographics change. Basically, it becomes less white. In that article that I read by John Derbyshire, he talked about the talented 10%. Now, with America's minority, with America's black minority, there are profound problems with illegitimacy. That's close. I think it's north of 70% now. And without addressing that, and at the same time bringing in, migrants from Africa or immigrants from Africa and Mexico and these things, and flooding the country, there's simply, as the demographics change, I don't see a country that's less than it's 50%, 45% of people from European extraction or background maintaining any sense of rule of law, any traditional American system of government. It's just not going to happen.
America's the only country I could think of that's ever, like, thought to itself, like, I have a ton of problems in this country that I need to fix, so I think I'm going to bring in even more problems.
Yes,
I think we can fix it.
Yeah, because we have a robust job market, we have demand for labor, and we have a balanced budget.
Right. Well, our families are intact.
We're intact, like, and there is an opioid crisis. Yeah, like, our industry's strong. It's
the militia element as well. I mean, it's like,
yeah,
it's getting rid of the original stock of this country.
And the point is that we can have democratic procedure and voting in these things, but master democracy is a head count, which means we're manipulated. Our votes don't really count anyway. But if you have, like, regions of loyalty there's a regional identity of certain ethnic groups, and these groups will kind of come together to defend their interests. You can hash that out in those terms as opposed to this myth we call democracy, So
yeah, they just don't want anything like the Battle of Athens to ever happen again, where you have people with any kind of local sense of themselves banding together to fight any kind of power structure. That's basically where we're at. Like, all this stuff ties together. It's all about control.
Yeah, it's all about, and that's the, about, you know, diversity is our strength is a way to weaken societies, control it, these things. So, well, I've had you on for 2 hours now.
Yeah.
I want to thank you for coming on the show.
That was great. I always love a one-on-one conversation because it allows me to stretch my legs and just go off.
I'm sure when I finish this, I'll... Oh, I should have brought this up, but it's been 2 hours.
Well, as my close friends can tell you, like, I can I'm one of those guys that can have the, you know, those 8 hour drinking conversations. Like, I just like I can filibuster for quite some time. So I'm sure. So, like, whatever you think of, just save it. Like, just write it down and just save it for the next time I'm on.
Great. Yeah. I'll definitely plan for that in the future. Where can people follow your work? Best place?
The Right Stuff app is where where all my podcasts are. Borza Boskovic on YouTube is where presently my YouTube is. We'll see how long that lasts. And my present Twitter account is Borpzoi, BORPZOI. However, at this present time, because I've been extremely critical of people who are extremely online, and I've always been aware, like, that criticism not only equally applies to me, it might apply to me more than anybody else. I have a very unhealthy relationship with social media and technology, which is where some of my critiques come from, because I know it firsthand. But I've been trying to deconnect from it. So I'll probably be still logging on from time to time, just like tweet announcements and the like. But for the time being, I'm kind of taking a break. But, you know, if you do the Twitter thing, Borpzoi, BORPZOI.
Okay, listen, well, thank you for spending so much time with me tonight.
Yeah, it was great.
And I'll probably post this next week. When I do, I'll send you the link.
Excellent. Yeah, I'll log on to Twitter, at least, or have my secretary post the retweet the link.
Great. Okay, thanks.
Yep, thank you.
Good night, then.
Good night.
Bye-bye.